Genre films have certain requirements, and that's true whether we're talking about a rock and roll biopic or a romantic comedy. The trick is, how original can you be within those constraints? Hi, I'm Dan Webster, host of Movies 101. And on this week's show, Meripat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I will discuss two films that take up that challenge, Rocket Man and Always Be My Maybe. After that, we'll give our final impressions of SIFF 2019. So don't touch that dial, because a genre-busting Movies 101 is coming up next, right here on Spokane Public Radio.
When you hear us say, listener-supported public radio, what are we really saying? Public radio is shorthand for thought-provoking, well-crafted, stimulating programs. Listener-supported means it's your money that pays for those programs. And not only the programs, but the transmitters, the computers, the electricity, everything it takes to bring you those programs. So here's a very large thank you to you, the listener, in listener-supported public radio.
Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Meripat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbinder, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio and film and music editor for The Inlander.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that is approaching summer pretty much the same way every other Inland Northwest resident is, by enjoying the sun when it deigns to come out. That is, we do whenever we're not watching movies, which we did last week, both in area theaters, in the comfort of our respective homes, and before that, while braving the lions at the 2019 Seattle International Film Festival. We're going to discuss the results of our efforts, which involve two fresh takes on standard genre offerings, the fantastical rock bio of Elton John titled Rocket Man, and the romantic comedy Always Be My Maybe, the latter of which we saw courtesy of Netflix. Before we close, we'll talk about our experiences at the 45th Seattle International Film Festival, during which, all told, the three of us saw 29 movies. Let's begin, though, with a look at one of the great musical performers of the late 20th century. As with all cinematic profiles of public celebrities, Dexter Fletcher's Rocket Man, an exploration of the life and career of pop rocker Elton John, follows a certain format. In much the same way that last year's Bohemian Rhapsody documented the story of Queen lead singer Freddie Mercury, Rocket Man gives us tidbits of the childhood endured by the boy born as Reggie Dwight, his early years as a performer, his professional breakthrough, and in relatively short order, his struggles with his sexual orientation, his battles with drink and drugs, and ultimately, unlike Mercury, his triumph. But Fletcher, who finished Bohemian Rhapsody when director Bryan Singer was fired, and working from a script by Lee Hall, injects a bit of magical realism into his film, making much of Rocket Man into a kind of rock and roll fantasy. That feel contrasts with other parts, which delve into a sober sense of authenticity involving the ultimate loneliness of the artist. But the overall result is an entertaining, if by the dots, recitation of the now 72-year-old John's life. Taron Egerton does a fine job in the lead role, even if his voice doesn't quite match that of the man he portrays, as does Jamie Bell as lyricist Bernie Taupin, Richard Madden as John's soulless agent manager, and Bryce Dallas Howard as the classical narcissist mother. If Fletcher's film doesn't exactly crocodile rock, it certainly shows why John himself can claim, "I'm still standing."
Oh, I see what you did there. Because those are the titles of Elton John songs.
Ooh.
Oh,
so,
clever.
I mean, the elephant in the room here when we're talking about Rocket Man is Bohemian Rhapsody, isn't it? And I think the
Absolutely.
Comparisons to that movie aren't coming about just because that was the last big musical biopic. Bohemian Rhapsody and Rocket Man have a lot in common. I mean, they're both portraits of British musicians who flourished in the early 70s. And when we're talking about both of those bands, they were fronted, well, Elton John and his band, and then Queen and Freddie Mercury, both of those bands were fronted by these performers with flamboyant stage presence and these men that were actively playing around with sexuality and gender norms at a time when that was not really accepted.
Mm-hmm.
But you also have the figure of John Reed, who is Elton John's manager and lover, and who also played a role in Queen's success and is portrayed in Bohemian Rhapsody as well. And then you've got the Dexter Fletcher factor, right, because he came in and finished Bohemian Rhapsody, as you said, and he's directed this movie. So all of these pieces are kind of aligning at the same time in a lot of weird ways. And yet I think that Rocketman is a better film than Bohemian Rhapsody.
It's certainly more ambitious, I think.
Yeah, and I don't want to sit here and compare the two because they were sort of made in vacuums. But right. I mean, I think we just have to get that out of the way. But I do prefer Rocketman if we're talking about just kind of standard boilerplate musical biopics. And I think it's because this movie is bigger and more ambitious, as you said. It's more fantastical and it's gayer than Bohemian Rhapsody was. And I liked that about it because it wasn't softening the edges of who Elton John was in the 70s and 80s. And that's all Bohemian Rhapsody did. It was this gauzy PG-13 version, right, of a rock and roll lifestyle that rang phony all the way through, except for the moments when Rami Malek could just let loose and play Freddie Mercury. And so here we have a movie that is bookended by these scenes in a recovery group. And as Elton John is reflecting on his life, we get these musical numbers that are sort of these different signposts for things that happen throughout his career and beyond. And I think that it really works when it does just kind of abandon reality and break into song. And I think that when we're looking at this in comparison to Rhapsody, I think that it has a lot of the same problems that that earlier movie did, which is the problems that all musical biopics have, which are all these conventions that they still have to keep bringing up. I mean, there are scenes in Rocketman that really do just feel like we're reading a paragraph off of a Wikipedia page a little bit, and there's lots of clunky dialogue and obvious allusions to things that happen. But I think that when it does go full on all that jazz, and there are a lot of like direct allusions to that,
yes,
to Ken Russell,
film, yes,
especially Tommy, which Elton John was an actor in, I think that's when the movie works. Even though this is an R-rated movie, and I mean, it's a light R, I think, but it's still R-rated, I kind of wish that this had gone even further than it did, because it does still feel like it was designed for the middle America matinee crowd a little bit. And of course, Elton John and his husband David Furnish are producers on this, so he has to come out looking kind of rosy in the end. But I like the fact that it was willing to go to the darker places that Bohemian Rhapsody didn't, and I think that we need more just straight up musicals, I think, in theaters. I appreciated the fact that this was unapologetically a big screen musical, even if it wasn't the greatest big screen musical I've ever seen.
I have to say, I love this movie.
Okay.
I was pleasantly surprised because, as you said, it was challenging because we just had this juxtaposition of the Freddie Mercury biopic. And I thought that this film, Rocketman, took the basic story, but because it had these, I think, memorable performances, I really like Bryce Dallas Howard in this movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, I thought, you know, she's put on a little weight for Black Mirror and for other things that she's been involved in. And she looked like the classic, as Dan said, she called her the classic mom figure who was not kind to her son.
Figure,
right,
yes.
Exactly. It was sort of musical, sort of magical realism, sort of straight biopic. I was skeptical that they'd be able to pull all of those things together. And I thought they did a fabulous job with that. I think maybe Rami Malek was a better Freddie Mercury than Taron Egerton was Elton John, but not by very much. And I would definitely encourage people to go see this movie. I mean, I have sort of an interesting response to Elton John because I don't really know where he's coming from. I mean, he played at Rush Limbaugh's wedding. Was that to take his money? Is he really friends with him? I don't know what the Princess Di piece is. But it was interesting, having seen him in 1976 on stage in Philadelphia and then seeing him a couple years ago here in Spokane, definitely a contrast, but I give him a lot of credit for hanging in there, for changing things up in his life, musically and so forth.
Yeah, and for going sober for so many years, almost three decades now. One thing interesting is a slight digression here. Mary Pat and I watched the Tony Awards this past week, and it struck me how many of these Broadway plays are now taken from movies. And that's what struck me, particularly it struck me when you were talking, Nathan, that you could just take this movie and immediately move it to,
yeah,
Broadway.
And in fact, this whole film, Rocketman, feels like a dry run for,
yes,
the inevitable.
Absolutely.
There's even a scene at the end where he's finally come to terms in his his rehab program, and all the characters from his life come out and stand in the background and deliver one last line. And I thought you would see that on a stage.
Absolutely.
And you wouldn't have to change much except maybe the blocking.
Absolutely.
And that's about it.
We talked about Bryce Dallas Howard, but Richard Madden, I liked him. I mean, he was in the limited miniseries Bodyguard, which we saw and liked it very much.
Of Game of Thrones.
And then Jamie Bell. Jamie Bell, who's been around for years.
He was Billy Elliot.
Billy Elliot all those years ago. And we know this guy can both sing and dance. And but he was not used to that extent, but he was a nice, solid presence to the Elton John character who's bouncing back and forth.
And we also see that because part of the problem with that a lot of people were talking about with Bohemian Rhapsody is that because everybody but Freddie Mercury is alive from that band, they all kind of got a say in how they were portrayed. And so there are scenes in Bohemian Rhapsody where Freddie Mercury is the lascivious one and all the other members of Queen are like, oh, we have to go home with our wives. And they're like, yeah, I'm sure. I liked that this movie at least portrayed Bernie Taupin as a guy who also had problems and also kind of had to get his act together at some point and was also wallowing in the fame and excess of the 70s and 80s. And it was nice to see him get his due within the story because there wouldn't be an Elton John without a Bernie Taupin. And he was kind of, you know, he was willing to kind of be back on the sidelines and just provide the words for the
music. You know, what's interesting, though, is I would like to have had them delve into that a little more because you're absolutely right. They created these songs separately. Taupin wrote the lyrics and then John wrote the music to it. But how does that work? I mean, how do you take those words and turn them into music? It was just too easy,
the way
it's portrayed in the film.
And we've talked about that before. That's a hard thing to portray in movies, and very few of them get it right. But I think that wall that they sort of built between them in their respective artistic processes could, I guess if they flesh it out on stage, they'd have to add another hour onto this thing, so maybe they could go into that. But I think as it stands, this is, relatively entertaining.
No, I
thought it was really entertaining.
So you thought it was better than Bohemian Rhapsody.
I did. Yeah.
Oh, I did. Well,
I think
we
all
agree
on
that. Yeah. And that was Rocket Man. This is Movies 101. It's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at Always Be My Maybe, and then to dispense our final thoughts about the just-finished 2019 Seattle International Film Festival. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
She packed my bags last night, pre-flight. 0 hour, 9 a.m. And I'm gonna be high as a kite by then. I miss the earth so much, I miss my life. It's lonely out in space. On such a timeless flight.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Toothart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed the Elton John biopic Rocket Man. Let's now move to another fresh take on genre filmmaking, the romantic comedy Always Be My Maybe. Following last year's Crazy Rich Asians, first-time feature filmmaker Nanachka Khan, working from a team-written script, infuses an original feel to a traditional genre by making it, in this case, a mostly Asian production. Ali Wong and Randall Park, co-screenwriters with Michael Gomalko, star as our protagonist couple, lifelong friends who, much like every other romantic pair in Hollywood history, discover that complete intimacy, i.e., that which includes sex, comes at a cost. Wong plays Sasha, a renowned chef who goes back and forth between major cities opening restaurants, while Park plays Marcus, a guy content to stay at home in San Francisco, working for his dad and performing with his barely more than a garage band quartet in small local venues. When the two become estranged and don't talk for more than a decade, they reconnect, cutely and reluctantly, and then the countdown begins to what we know is inevitable, the climactic kiss marking their ultimate reunion. Always Be My Maybe works mostly, even if much of it feels as if it's straining for a laugh track, and if nothing else, an appearance by none other than Keanu Reeves qualifies as the cameo of the year.
Well, I certainly agree with that last statement, and we're going to sort of have to talk around that plot point a little bit. But since you mentioned he shows up, that truly is a highlight in Always Be My Maybe. But I really did like the two protagonists. I mean, I think that they both have comedic chops. I think that Ali Wong is, I'm more familiar with her as a stand-up comedian, and Randall Park has one of the most expressive faces. I mean, I think of some of the classic SNL performers over time, and he definitely rivals them in the almost over-the-top facial expressions that he makes throughout this entire rom-com. I think it's accurately called especially in this context. But I'm not sure that there's anything truly outstanding about this particular movie, except for the Keanu cameo, which I thought was like way well worth watching. But, you know, I like the supporting performances. I don't think that this guy's band really had any talent whatsoever. So that was
Hello Carol, they're called.
Right. That was perhaps, you know, something that could have been addressed a little bit more directly here. But it's cute. The performances are worth watching, and I had fun.
Yeah, I mean, I think movies like Always Be My Baby kind of live
Always
in,
Be My Maybe.
Always Be My Maybe. I've got Mariah Carey on the brain.
Yes.
I mean, movies like this, they live and die by the chemistry of their two leads. I mean, that's how romantic comedies have always been. And I think Ali Wong and Randall Park have it. I mean, I believed that they were friends, I believe that they were romantically involved, all of that. And it hits all the beats you expect. You know, they're in different social standings, and that creates a rift. And they both have the eccentric significant other, one of whom happens to be Keanu Reeves. And then they're basically yanked apart in the second act so they can come back together in the third. And we know all of that.
Yes.
But I think it kind of coasts by on the likability of its stars. I also liked Michelle Buteau as the friend and manager of this new restaurant. And James Saito is really funny as Randall Park's dad in this. So, I mean, I think Netflix is really the perfect platform for a movie like this, because it's solid, but it's not, like you said, it's nothing new, especially after something like Crazy Rich Asians, which really seemed to breathe new life back into this genre and actually had something to say on a cultural level.
Right, right.
Well, I think that you're correct that this did play with the notions of home and being home and what being accepted and celebrity and all of those things. Mm-hmm. So it plays with some of those themes.
Yeah.
Maybe not as dramatically, although there are
foodies. Foodies are going to like this movie.
Yeah, sure.
Right,
although,
right.
Again, there was more food in Crazy Rich Asians.
That's
that
true.
Whole scene where they go to the street vendors, that was great.
Yeah.
Anyway, it just makes me want to watch that movie again.
Yeah.
But this one's okay.
And that was Always Be My Maybe, which is awkward to say. Let's close by offering closing comments about our respective experiences at the just-finished 2019 Seattle International Film Festival. And you talked a couple of weeks ago about your experience, Nathan, but you can reiterate what your feelings were. We saw, what did we see, 18 films in
5 days?
In 5 days, yeah. So it all kinds of runs together, and we can't, most of them are embargoed, so we can't really say, hey, you need to go see this movie. But there are some movies that are going to come up this summer. And
Late Night, most, which was a big
you saw
hit
that
at the festival. Maybe.
Right, Emma Thompson and Mindy Kaling. We'll be reviewing it in a couple of weeks, I think, but that's one to look out for. Right.
Well, and the thing is, when you say they're embargoed, I think the whole point is, rather than giving specific in-depth reviews in advance, I think what they'd like to do is have us talk about the festival, and then when the movie actually comes out, we can tell you about our experience seeing the movie at that time.
And I think you can kind of give a vague thumbs up, thumbs down.
Right. I think so, too. Now, for those of you who have not been to SIFF for a couple of years, now most of the screenings are at the Uptown Theater, which SIFF owns.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are three theaters there. And it does make the logistics a lot easier than once was the case when you would be running up to the U District and
over to the Egyptian,
right,
and the Harvard exit back in the day.
And those that aren't playing there are over at the Pacific Place, which is it's easier parking. It's expensive parking, but it's easier parking
because it's a
rather
mall.
Than the uptown.
And
yeah.
Now, I mean, there are screenings in Kirkland, there are screenings
Shoreline,
Majestic Bay. So I think it's a really nice addition to the festival. And as
it's
always,
real different from the days in which we had to drive from one theater to the next in between the half-hour screenings. So it's a lot easier to navigate.
Right, and you can get tickets in advance always. You know, occasionally there are sellouts, but that's not necessarily commonplace. We were able to go to some press screenings, and if you get a full series festival pass, then you can attend those press screenings too. We actually ran into people who had seen 110 movies.
Whoa.
Yeah.
So, yes, so they were
and that
really
was with a week
power
to go.
Movie going, yes.
That's insane.
Yeah,
like,
that is insane.
Like, we do
exactly.
this pretty much professionally, and I can't even imagine doing
that.
How are you able to even keep track of
what
you've seen?
Well, it was interesting because people did have their own little playbooks and were exchanging information. They were exchanging ideas. I mean, it was fun just to stand in line and ask people, what was your favorite film?
Yeah,
and
sure.
Of course, I always gravitate toward the docs, and I think a film that we'll be screening soon is a biography. I don't know if it's a biopic because that's fictional, right?
Yeah, right.
So it's a documentary about Molly Ivins.
Raise Hell, The Life and Times of Molly Ivins.
Oh, yeah.
And that was really well worth watching. And, of course, the delights that come from going to a festival are seeing things that you probably would not necessarily have the opportunity or you wouldn't necessarily gravitate towards. So we saw this one film, Awakening of the Ants, which actually won one of the jury prizes from Costa Rica. And it was sort of a women's awakening film, but small little picture. We also saw a film that gave both me and Dan nightmares. And the filmmaker won Best Director. It's called Sons of Denmark, about neo-Nazis. It's a fictional film about
neo-Nazis
in Denmark.
In Denmark. Director Ulla Salim won the Best Director. But it's about neo-Nazis being confronted by Muslims, and people get caught up in between the struggle here, and innocent lives get... Oh, I did have nightmares after that film.
Did either of you see Tel Aviv on Fire?
No,
this is the movie that won the Golden Space Needle Award, which is the top award at SIFF, and it's actually
top
set to open
award,
at the Magic Lantern on August 23rd. So
okay,
if you
great.
Didn't see it at SIFF, it's coming out in a couple of months.
That's
one of the great things about SIFF is because even though, you know, it's smaller movies, it's movies from other countries, sometimes from countries you didn't even know were producing movies,
Right. Documentaries,
as you said, they're not always playing multiplexes, but the Magic Lantern gets these movies and Netflix picks them up. So you can always see them if you miss them at the festival.
And we did see a film that I also, a documentary that I also really appreciated called Ghost Fleet, which was about fishermen who were basically trafficked into working in the fishing industry in Southeast Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a Vulcan-produced doc, Vulcan being Paul Allen's a company based
Paul
out
Allen's
of Seattle.
Right. Company based.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
And so, again, we'll have more information about the films that we saw.
They open. Yes,
yes, absolutely.
And as they open, either in theaters, as you pointed out, Nathan, a lot of these might come to the Magic Lantern, or if not, they'll be available video on demand sooner or later. So that was our look at the 45th Seattle International Film Festival. It's time to go now. This is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster. And earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbinder, Mary Pat Truthart, and I discussed Rocket Man and Always Be My Maybe. Let's take this moment to thank Jim Tevenin for both producing and engineering the show. We thank you, too, our loyal listeners, and we invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again try to separate cinema wheat from cinema chaff. Until then, remember these words from lyricist Bernie Taupin, written about Marilyn Monroe, but just as fitting for his writing partner Elton John. Loneliness was tough, the toughest role you ever played. Hollywood created a superstar, and pain was the price you paid. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.